Hello, and welcome to Sun Sounds of Arizona. I'm David Rogowski, and today I will be reading from Outside Magazine. Okay, our first article is entitled, National Park Visitors Should Lower Your Expectations This Summer. The National Park Service faces a staffing crisis after losing 1,000 employees. We spoke to experts and laid-off rangers to understand what visitors can expect. This is by Frederick Dreyer. By now, you've probably heard about the staffing crisis gripping Yellowstone, Yosemite, and the nation's other national parks. On February 14th, the National Park Service delivered layoff notices to approximately 1,000 workers, or about 5% of its total workforce. The move generated headlines in national and local publications alike. And over the weekend, dozens of recently fired National Park Service workers penned heartfelt essays on social media about losing the jobs they loved. "I am the toilet scrubber and soap dispenser," a fired National Park Service ranger named Brian Gibbs wrote on Facebook. "I am the open trail hiked by people from all walks of life. I am the highlight of your child's school day." Outside reached out to National Park Service for comment, but did not hear back by the time the story published. The agency told Politico, "The National Park Service is assessing our most critical staffing needs for park operations for the coming season and is working to hire key positions. The National Park Service is committed to protecting public lands, infrastructure, and communities while ensuring public access." The workforce upheaval stems from Trump administration's efforts to dramatically shrink the federal government, which in 2024 employed approximately 3 million people, not including the military. In January, the administration announced a hiring freeze in all federal agencies and offered buyouts to government workers willing to resign. Since then, almost every wing of the U.S. government has been impacted by the belt tightening. But the Park Service cuts are the ones that will impact the summer vacation plans of millions of Americans. Outside spoke to National Park Service experts and former employees about the staff changes to see how they will impact daily life at America's favorite vacation destinations. We asked these experts whether park visitors will be able to see a difference when they hike on trails, arrive at visitor centers, or use the restroom. The answer, you bet. "Expect fewer services, less help, and fewer projects like trails or construction getting fixed," said Kristen Brengel, the Senior Vice President of Government Affairs at the National Parks Conservation Association, the NPCA, a nonprofit advocacy group for the National Park Service. "You'll need to lower your expectations." Which National Park Service workers were cut? Over the weekend, the National NPCA tracked the layoffs and spoke to National Park Service staffers who lost their jobs. According to Brengel, the current cuts impacted all 63 U.S. national parks and all 433 areas managed by the Park Service. The cuts did not target specific jobs, she said, but were indiscriminate. "We've heard from wildlife biologists, archaeologists, even wastewater treatment operators who were let go," Brengel said. "We're talking about people with incredible expertise losing jobs. It will throw some parks into a tailspin." Rather than target specific positions, the cuts impacted employees with probationary status, a designation given to federal employees for the first year of their employment in a position. According to the New York Times, the strategy was in line with the Trump administration's plan to dismiss the 200,000 or so federal workers with this designation. The letter sent to laid-off employees read like a termination notice for low performance, according to the Times. "The department determined that you have failed to demonstrate fitness or qualifications for continued employment because your subject matter knowledge, skills, and abilities do not meet the department's current needs," read the letter, distributed to some National Park Service staff. Brengel points out that not every probationary worker is new or unqualified. Some veteran National Park Service workers were given the status after they were promoted to managerial positions. Was also given to seasonal National Park Service employees who had recently been hired to year-round positions. "The ripple effect of these firings will be felt immediately," she said. "It's going to be a huge brain drain to lose a lot of these positions." Gibbs, 41, is one such employee. Prior to taking a full-time position at Iowa's Effigy Mounds National Monument, which is managed by the National Park Service, he had spent 4 years working as a seasonal interpretive ranger at Glacier National Park. Interpretive rangers help visitors understand the cultural significance of an area. Gibbs took that expertise to his job at Effigy Mounds, where he managed educational programs for kids, among other jobs. "At such a small monument, I wore many hats," he told Outside. "On the day I got fired, I was creating a program to take kids snowshoeing in the park." Then what services will be lost? It may take several weeks to determine which services will be eliminated at each park. Brengel and others have told visitors to expect to encounter long lines, overflowing trash cans, unkempt bathrooms, and other drop-offs in service caused by a lack of manpower. One anonymous National Park Service employee told Politico to expect to see poop on trails. Brengel said that the major construction projects started in 2024, such as trail maintenance or road paving, are likely to be left unfinished. In the days since the layoffs, fired National Park Service employees have shared their stories and the jobs the National Park Service is losing with local and national media. A worker named Oleg Chmura told TV station Fox 26 News that he no longer pick up trash and scoop up feces at Yosemite National Park. The New York Times interviewed multiple National Park Service workers impacted by the cuts, among them Helen Dew, a park guide at Palo Alto Battlefield National Historic Park in Brownsville, Texas, and Stacy Ramsey, a river ranger in Arkansas's Buffalo National River. The latter told the Times that she writes warnings for the general public when the parts of the river are dangerous. If no one is there to educate, it increases the risk of someone getting hurt on the river, Ramsey told the Times. Politico quoted an anonymous National Park Service ranger in California who wrote about his termination on Facebook. I honestly can't imagine how the parks will operate without my position, he said. I am the only EMT at my park and the first responder for any emergency. According to the Associated Press, 16 of the 17 supervisor positions at Wyoming's Grand Teton National Park were axed. At Shenandoah National Park, trail maintenance workers and fee collectors lost their job. Gibbs' job at Effigy Mounds was focused on education. He developed classroom programs, took schools on tours of the area when they arrived on field trips, and also visited local schools to discuss the cultural significance of the park. Effigy Mounds preserves 200 or so prehistoric earthworks that were built by pre-Columbian people. Some of the mounds are in the shapes of birds and bears. Gibbs was one of two employees at Effigy Mounds to be let go. Just seven rangers remain, he said. Educating kids about cultural resources at Effigy Mounds will come to a stop, and schools visiting will have a self-guide at the park, Gibbs told Outside. Kids and families are the ones who are going to lose out. And what about the National Park Service hiring freeze? Not all the National Park Service news on Friday was bad. The Trump administration published a memo saying agency received an exemption from the federal hiring freeze to bring back some seasonal workers for the spring and summer. The move allows National Park Service to hire back 5,000 or so seasonal employees whose jobs were rescinded in January when the freeze was announced across all federal agencies. Most parks rely heavily on seasonal workers, and each year, National Park Service hires between 7,000 and 8,000 of them to help during the busiest periods. The reaction to the news was mixed. Exempting National Park Service seasonal staff from the federal hiring freeze means parks can fill some visitor service positions, said Teresa Perno, CEO of the NPCA, in a statement. But with park season just weeks away, the decision to slash 1,000 permanent full-time jobs from the national parks is reckless and could have serious public safety and health consequences. The timeline for hiring back seasonal workers has not been made public. According to Politico, only about 300 seasonal positions had been granted exemptions as of February 18th. Brangle pointed out that seasonal workers might not be able to replace the full-time National Park Service employees who are lost in the layoffs. Some of the cut National Park Service workers who spoke to the NPCA were coordinators of seasonal labor, she said. For example, the 16 managers who lost their jobs at Grand Teton National Park help oversee seasonal workers. Seasonal workers can't replace full-time positions, she said. Which parks have been hit the hardest? It may take until the busy summer months to assess the true impact of Friday's cuts on individual national parks and monuments. Brangle said that small parks with tiny staffs may suffer the worst, and that cuts there would be forced remaining employees to make tough choices. They may have to choose between keeping the visitor center open and the campground open, she said. These are the choices that smaller parks are going to have to make. But other parks are already feeling the pinch caused by the hiring freeze, layoffs, and other policy changes, according to the San Francisco Chronicle. Yosemite National Park will abandon its reservation system, which was made permanent earlier this year. Sources told the outlet the park tabled the plan after the Trump administration asked to review it. And what's the human cost? Like all mass layoffs, the National Park Service cuts have upended lives and forced thousands to seek new livelihoods. Ramsey told the Times that she lost her job after spending 3 years working a contract position with the National Park Service just to get her foot in the door. Gibbs echoed this sentiment when he spoke to Outside. He called his position at Effigy Mounds National Monument a dream job. He said that losing the position has forced his family into a dire financial situation. We're sad and frightened and feel like we've had the rug pulled out from under us, Gibbs said. Gibbs and his wife have a four-year-old son, and they're expecting a second child this year. Gibbs said that his wife had to skip a monitoring appointment with her doctor after the family's health insurance was terminated. We feel frozen about what our next steps are, he said. The cuts have prompted action in some communities. Over the weekend, protesters stood outside visitor centers at Joshua Tree and Yosemite National Parks. On Tuesday, February 18th, National Park Service workers and their friends and families lined the streets of Estes Park, Colorado, just outside the Rocky Mountain National Park to protest. Should you visit National Park this summer? The sources we spoke to still encourage Americans to visit national parks this summer. Despite the cuts, yes, trails may be closed, parking lots may be messy, and lines may be longer than normal. Instead, Gibbs said National Park Service visitors should do advance homework before traveling to see which trails close, which services are limited. Reconsider trips deep into the backcountry since manpower for life-saving rescues may be diminished, and stay on the trails. Know that there's probably going to be a disruption in safety and resource protection, Gibbs said. Gibbs and Brengel urge visitors to have patience and understanding with the National Park Service employees who are manning the parks. Brengel said visitors should consider saying thank you to National Park Service rangers. Think about what a difficult time it must be for them, knowing that they may be next on the chopping block, Brengel said. They are going to be stretched thin, but they are the heroes for sticking it out. And our next article is entitled, Meet Muppy, the world's smallest sled dog. Most sled dogs are huskies and pointers, but Muppy didn't get the memo. With sheer determination and a whole lot of heart, this little dog is rewriting the rules of racing. It's by Blair Braverman. Last fall, at a dryland dog sled race in Pearson, Wisconsin, one canine athlete stood out from the rest. While her competition, mostly pointers and Alaskan huskies, ran 1 to 3 mile sprints, then rested, she entered multiple divisions in such quick succession that she once hurried straight from the finish line to the starting line without slowing down. Her gaze is stoic, her fur is orange, her legs are 4 inches long. Musher Betsy Height of Wausau, Wisconsin, didn't plan for 18-pound dachshund mix Muppy to become one of the most recognizable sled dogs in the Midwest. As it turns out, that was all Muppy's idea. I could never get Muppy to walk on a leash, Betsy told me over the phone. I'm a dog sledder myself and cheer for Muppy at races, but I don't know Betsy well. I reached out to learn the full story. Someone commented that I should walk faster, so I walked faster, and then Muppy started running, so I started running. And then she started running faster. I don't have the cardio for that, so I hooked her up to a bike and off she went. I was like, oh, I guess this is a thing. Betsy grew up on a dairy farm in the southern part of the state. As a kid, she sometimes hooked up the farm collars to plastic sled with baler twine, then threw snowballs for them to chase so they'd pull her. But those experiments, plus the movie Snow Dogs, were the only context she had for sled dog sports. So she turned to YouTube for urban mushing tutorials, which explained the basics of bike drawing, scooter drawing, and canicross, dogs pulling bikes, scooters, and human runners, respectively. The videos were helpful, but geared towards folks with husky and other big dogs. They didn't address many of the problems she encountered, like that Muppy was so short that she had to swim through puddles. Plus, where do you find a good harness that size? But Muppy loved pulling so much that Betsy was determined to figure it out. She contacted a harness company called Nonstop, ordering their smallest adjustable size, and got some goggles so that Muppy's eyes were protected from sticks and burdock. They trained on deer trails in the woods by their house. Muppy was ecstatic to pull, and her never-ending energy felt like magic, even when she turned to chase critters and Betsy went flying. I got really good at reading her body language, she told me. I can tell by the way she holds her tail if she's locked onto something ahead of us, whether it's a person in the distance or an unsuspecting rabbit. Betsy learned to brace herself, and Muppy learned not to swerve. She throws into the harness even more to get out that frustration. When Muppy was 4 in 2021, Betsy posted a picture on Facebook, and a page called Twin Cities Dog Powered Sports liked her post. I sent some messages to their page asking them 900 different questions, and they were super helpful. When she saw that they were hosting a first-time race in Minnesota, she signed up for the 1.3-mile bike touring event. She was terrified. For one thing, Betsy didn't know if the other mushers would accept her, but my biggest fear, she said, was that someone would pass us. That summer, Muppy had been attacked by 3 golden retrievers at a park, and she'd been sketchy around strange dogs ever since. How would she react to a team coming up behind them? Betsy made a plan. If another team approached, she would veer off trail and sit on the ground, holding Muppy until they were gone. As it turned out, she and Muppy both had so much adrenaline, we were pedal to the metal, that no other teams came close. They finished the course in just 5.5 minutes, averaging 14 miles per hour. The duo didn't make the podium, but they weren't on the bottom either. After that, they were hooked. When most people picture sled dogs, they imagine huskies racing 1,000 miles through snowy wilderness. But in dry land racing, ever-growing corner of the sport, teams consisting of 1 to 6 dogs compete in parks, cities, and small towns worldwide. Mushers gather at trailheads and parking lots for long weekends of racing, with world champion sprinters, often huge, muscular pointers with legs a mile long. Competing alongside teams of purebred Siberians and assorted mutts, when Betsy and Muppy first started showing up at races, people assumed that Muppy belonged to a spectator or that she was a pet accompanying another team. But it wasn't long before they took her seriously as both a friend and competition. Muppy's not the fastest dog on the race circuit, but she's among the most recognizable, and crowds will sometimes gather to chant her name. The affection is mutual. There's a bar on the country road that leads to one of the race sites, and whenever Betsy makes the turn in her car, Muppy starts screeching with excitement. In the starting chute, while the judges count down, she wails, eyes glued to the trail ahead, and the moment Betsy releases the brake, they take off at top speed. She's become a pro at some of the more technical aspects of racing, like getting past, or just as often, passing. The dog parts of other teams, sometimes they just stare as they're running, trying to decide if she's food or friend, Betsy recalled, laughing, and their mushers will say, come on, Snowball, you're getting passed by a wiener dog. For the past 4 years during dryland season, Muppy races frequently and trains by pulling Betsy or her husband 2 to 3 miles up to 4 times a week. Betsy works at a composting facility and even brings Muppy to work sometimes so she can practice running up and down the compost rows, which smell enticing, making them perfect practice for resisting distraction. Till this year, winter's been Muppy's off-season. She spends the snowy months digging and shredding sticks. But Betsy recently bought a fat bike, and the duo have been training for fat biking enduring races on the snow. Last May, Betsy and her husband adopted a second dog, Journey, who's a terrier-shepherd mix. Journey's bigger than Muppy and not that into pulling, but she does love running, so sometimes they enter two dog races together. Muppy pulls and Journey simply runs alongside her. Betsy doesn't mind. The point of dog-powered sports, as she sees it, is to make dogs' lives richer, and that means embracing each dog's skills and interests. So as long as Journey's happy, she's happy too. As for Muppy, she's fully embraced her role as an icon. She prances when fans call her name. Betsy thrilled to be her ambassador. If someone has a pet with boundless energy, a sport like this is a great opportunity for them, she told me. Even for a dog who doesn't pull like Journey, being out in front and making decisions seems to tuck her out more than games of fetch ever did. But Betsy's favorite thing has been seeing how much joy and inspiration Muppy's athleticism brings to people. I want to show that little dogs can do things, she said proudly, and help more dogs live enriching lives. And that was about Muppy the sled dog. And our next article is entitled, You Can Always Crash on My Couch. No hotel, no problem. I've perfected the art of traveling on connection, karma, and the occasional borrowed futons by Carolyn Hyland. I left Breckenridge on July 3rd and headed west without a plan. I crashed the night before with my friend Sorrell at the mountainside condo she was renting full-time. I was on a seat of my pants road trip around Colorado without a place to sleep on the eve of one of the biggest camping holidays of the year. At a highway rest stop in the early afternoon, I sent a Hail Mary DM to a college acquaintance named Emily, who lived in Crested Butte, to see if she was around and would let me crash. Come through, she responded, we can go skiing. We've seen each other once or twice since graduation, but we were mostly internet friends who both loved nerding out on skiing, social justice, and reading. 2 hours later, I pulled up in front of her house. Emily outfitted me with a cut-off Canadian tuxedo, and we set off for the Paradise Divide. We boot-packed up 300 vertical foot snowfield and made the most of what remained of winter snowpack. I laughed to myself as slush hit my bare legs with each turn, marveling at how much less interesting my day would have been if I just tried to find a dispersed spot to sleep on my own. I took off from my cousin Julie's house in Salt Lake City, Utah the next day, exhilarated by my connecting the dots across the West, without dropping a penny on lodging. I started to travel this way in my early 20s, plotting destinations based on where I had someone to crash with for free. It's a natural dirtbag urge to eliminate the cost of lodging from travel, to drive your truck down a forest service road and sleep in the back, to nestle under a throw blanket on your friend's couch, to lay your sleeping pad in the dirt on BLM land. In the U.S., a small Airbnb for two adults typically costs $125, according to NerdWallet. On average, a hotel room will run you about $150, so staying for free can save up to $1,000 for a week-long trip. It can also put an otherwise financially out-of-reach tourist destination on the table. Lindsay, a renewable energy policy director friend of mine based in Rockport, Maine, admits that visiting Tahoe during peak ski season was only possible for her and her family because they house sat for a friend who was away. I worked in outdoor education, leading trips for 4 summers, which meant I ended up with the connections exactly the type of places I wanted to go. A friend in Gunnison, Colorado to crash with when it was a powder day. A place to stay in Jackson, Wyoming when it was prime time to see wildflowers and float the snake. Folks to visit in Bend, Oregon when it came time to recertify my wilderness first responder and ride bikes. The savings on lodgings are just the beginning. On previous visits to Crested Butte, a friend got me buddy passes at the resort and free slices during a shift at the pizza place in town. When I crashed on my friend Eddie's couch in Jackson Hole, he punched out my touring boots for free during one of his shifts at the shop. The rich get richer, as they say. Saving money isn't the only benefit of traveling this way. Crashing with friends makes a frugal way to travel, but having a network of people to stay with is indicative of social wealth. Being connected to folks in expensive mountain towns can open up the list of accessible destinations and in turn grow the network even more. I reconnected with Emily in Crested Butte while visiting my friend Colt, who lived there, and when he moved away, I still had a place to crash. More importantly, when I'm staying with locals, I get to tap into the heart of each place in a way I wouldn't if I came on my own. Following friends around the mountain and finding hidden stashes, tagging along to house parties, learning which pullouts along the river have fewer crowds. For those without an established network of friends in mountain towns, there is couch surfing, a service that connects budget travelers to a global community of friends that haven't met yet, according to their website. When I was traveling in Argentina in 2013 with my college roommate, we met an American on an overnight bus who put us in touch with two couch surfing hosts in Bariloche. where she had just left and where we were headed. A few days later, we huffed it up a winding dirt road to meet Julian and Alejandra, who not only let us blow up our sleeping bags on their tile floor, but cooked and played music with us, showed us around the city, and gave us priceless insider trail recommendations. We were supposed to stay for 2 days, but 4 days later, we were still there, soaking it all in. In my mid-20s, I lived alone in a three-bedroom house on the side of North Table Mountain that had absurdly low rent in Golden, Colorado. It was a thrill to be able to open my doors to others like they'd open theirs to me. I'd pile friends in sleeping bags on the living room floor after karaoke nights at the dive bar in town, or unfold the futon in the gear room for visitors passing through to ski. It was big enough that friends began offering it to their friends. My friend Emma was living in a tiny studio and had a friend visiting for a few days to take the single pitch instructor course required to be a rock guide. Could she possibly stay with me instead? I'd only met Betsy once, but it seemed like a no-brainer. This had something to do with having the space and something to do with the way I wanted to be in the world. I wanted to be open to experiences and people and the ways we can mutually support each other. I wanted to leave room for magic. Over the next few days, Betsy slept on the futon in my gear room. We split meals and got to connect one-on-one in a way we wouldn't have otherwise. Extended time in a shared space leads to a depth of conversation that just doesn't happen grabbing a beer at a brewery or on a bike ride. She passed her course, hugged me goodbye, and headed back to Jackson. Betsy wasn't just Emma's friend now, she was my friend too. A while later, my college roommate, Natalie, called me and asked if her new boyfriend would crash with me on his way back to Temple University, where they were both in med school. I hadn't met Mark and had just gone through a breakup. I didn't exactly feel like making conversation with a stranger. When he pulled up, I summoned everything inside me to get to know someone who mattered to someone who mattered to me. We hung out at my back deck, drank beers, and chatted and laughed for hours. It turned out that having a favorite person in common made it easy for us to get along. I went to bed that night, reminded that I could still laugh, that there are still good people in the world, and that there might be joy and experiences I couldn't possibly predict ahead. When you live with your arms open to others, you never know when the karma might come back your way. 4 years after Betsy slept on my futon, she became an editor at Backcountry Magazine. I got a text from her out of the blue saying, "Pitch me some ideas. We'd love to publish your writing." 5 years after Mark stayed with me in Golden, he married Natalie. When I fell trail running and tore my shin open, I FaceTimed Mark, now an ER doctor from the parking lot, to see if he thought I needed stitches. Crashing with friends turns hard goodbyes with people you love into a glorious network of landing pads all over the world. It converts people you never met into people you shared coffee and conversation with. It turns mountain towns of the world into accessible and affordable destinations. It is personal and intimate in a way that hotels and Airbnbs and sleeping alone in your truck are not. This form of travel may seem best suited to unattached dirt bags in their 20s, but doesn't have to be confined to that demographic. If you're down to get creative with sleep solutions, you can keep your arms open to visitors and your mind open to visiting others. My 65-year-old dad parked his camper in our driveway when he came through Truckee, California on a ski trip. I slept in Lindsay's ancient van in her driveway when she was living in a one-bedroom apartment in Boulder with her husband and two-year-old. I stayed with Natalie's parents after my lodging fell through for her wedding, feeling like the fifth Taylor sister by the end of the weekend. We might all pass through moments of life where it's easier for us to be hosts or to be hosted for a variety of reasons. I invite you all to join the church of You Can Always Crash on My Couch, where the belief in karma is strong and the latch string is always out. A year ago, my partner, Andy, and I moved to Anchorage, Alaska. In some ways, it would fundamentally change the way we traveled. No longer would we be spontaneously crash with folks on a multi-state road trip or have folks crash with us passing through to other destinations in the West. But in Anchorage, we finally upgraded to a guest room with a real bed and a door that closed. The pain of leaving our communities in the West was eased by the knowledge that we'd be able to host people on their way to the Alaskan Range, that we could lure visitors in with backcountry skiing and wild picked berry pancakes and conversation around the breakfast table, and we'd always be able to get back to the lower 48 to our twinkling constellation of landing pads all over the country. Next article is entitled, "The 7 Best Road Trips in the Southwest, from exploring Arizona's canyons to surfing California's A-beaches and hiking Utah's buttes," our national parks columnist shares his dream Southwest road trip itineraries. Just gas up your rig, grab the sunscreen, and go. The Southwest always seems to me like a bit of a fever dream. The country's deepest canyons, wildest buttes, and broadest deserts spread here from the Gulf of Mexico to the Pacific Ocean. Offering landscapes so unlike any other in the country, you might think you've left Earth altogether. It is a hot and hospitable territory that demands respect, but is also outrageously beautiful, with rock outcroppings that seem painted in shades of red and white, blooming cacti and shifting dunes that undulate like waves onto the horizon. The easiest and most efficient way to explore the Southwest is by car, bouncing from one breathtaking adventure to the next. So I've created 7 different road trip itineraries, one in each state of this stunning slice of our nation. I've driven the majority of these routes, while the remaining few are on my list of dream adventures. And each of these has something for everyone: beaches, sand dunes, cliffs, rivers, hikes, bike rides, fishing holes, and more. Set your playlist and pack the sunscreen. Here are the 7 best road trips in the Southwest. Number 1, Las Vegas to the Valley of Fire. 175 miles, 3 days by car. The obvious and most common road trip from Vegas would be to beeline straight for the Grand Canyon, but you do not want to overlook the suite of public lands that rings Sin City. The fun begins just 20 miles west of downtown Las Vegas at Red Rock Canyon National Conservation Area, a 195,000-acre park that is internationally known for its multi-pitch rock climbing, though my epic ventures here have been of other types. My favorite way to explore Red Rock is by road bike, pedaling the 13-mile scenic drive through the heart of the park. The road has one-way traffic and a big shoulder, so there's plenty of room, and you'll have both long-range and up-close views of the surrounding red sandstones and canyons. Las Vegas Cyclery has bike rentals from $40 a day. If you show up in the summer, do your ventures early in the morning before the heat gets unbearable. Next, skirt around the south side of Las Vegas for 70 miles to Lake Mead National Recreation Area, home to the massive Hoover Dam. I like Lake Mojave, a shallow, more narrower reservoir below Hoover that follows the original path of the Colorado River through a series of canyons. If you're looking for a full day or multi-day adventure, paddle a piece of the 30-mile Black Canyon National Water Trail, which begins at the base of the dam and ends in Arizona, passing beaches, hot springs, and side canyons. Only boaters with commercial license can launch below the dam, so hook up with Desert Adventures, which offers do-it-yourself rentals and shuttles or guided trips throughout the water trail. Or for a quicker adventure, drive directly to Willow Beach and paddle 2 miles upstream to Emerald Cave, a narrow side canyon with clear, shallow water below 75-foot sandstone walls, and tours from $139 per person and rentals from $80 per boat. Willow Beach Campground has tent sites and RV sites in the hills above the sandy beach for $45 a night. Driving north, you can stop at Valley of Fire State Park, Nevada's largest state park at 46,000 acres, where red and pink sandstone cliffs and canyons fill the valley, the walls popping out of the tan, scrubby dirt. Catch the area at sunset, and you could think the whole valley is on fire. The park is full of short, scenic trails for hikers. The 3.3-mile White Dome Loop takes into iconic features from a narrow slot canyon to the sinuous fire wave, where the striped sandstone seems to flow like water. Shag a campsite and one of the 2 developed campgrounds from $10. And we'll continue the rest of these next week, so stay tuned. Thank you. You have been listening to Sun Sounds of Arizona, and I've been reading from Outside Magazine. My name is Dave Rogowski. Thank you for listening.